In the world of Edwardian England, young Lucy Honeychurch stands at a crossroads that will define not just her future, but her very soul. When we first meet her at the Pension Bertolini in Florence, she's disappointed by her room without a view, a perfect metaphor for her constrained existence. The offer from the socially awkward Emersons to swap rooms sets in motion a profound awakening. This seemingly minor act of kindness becomes the first crack in the facade of propriety that has shaped Lucy's understanding of herself and the world. What begins as a simple tourist holiday transforms into an existential journey as Lucy discovers that the most important views aren't of the Arno River, but of life's authentic possibilities. Florence works its magic on Lucy in ways she never anticipated. Without her trusty Baedeker guidebook in Santa Croce Church, she feels momentarily lost. Yet this very disorientation creates space for genuine experience rather than prescribed appreciation. When she witnesses a violent altercation between Italians and the Piazza Signoria that ends in bloodshed, she faints, only to awaken in George Emerson's arms. His unconventional honesty about throwing away her bloodstained photographs puzzles her, yet touches something deep within. The Italian countryside becomes the setting for Lucy's pivotal moment. Wandering through violet-carpeted hills, she encounters George, who, overcome by the beauty surrounding them, kisses her passionately. Before she can process her feelings, Charlotte discovers them and whisks her away to Rome, extracting a promise of silence that will haunt Lucy for months to come. Italy represents everything England is not, passionate, direct, and unbound by stifling social codes. The Mediterranean sunshine illuminates not just ancient buildings, but hidden corners of Lucy's heart. Each encounter with the Emersons challenges her understanding of propriety, suggesting that true connection might require abandoning the very rules she's been raised to revere. Back in Surrey, Lucy becomes engaged to Cecil Vyse, cultured, sophisticated, and everything proper society values. Yet something essential is missing. Cecil views Lucy as a Leonardo painting, rather than a flesh-and-blood woman with desires of her own. Their woodland kiss proves awkward and passionless. His pince-nez gets flattened between them, and he laments not being more passionate like any laborer or navvy. Haven't we all experienced relationships where we're appreciated not for who we are, but for who someone imagines us to be? Cecil's fundamental flaw isn't malice, but blindness. He cannot see beyond his own intellectual framework to connect with Lucy's essential nature. When he interrupts her piano playing to request different music, he demonstrates his inability to recognize or nurture her passionate soul. In a delicious twist of fate, Cecil unwittingly orchestrates his own downfall by recommending the Emersons as tenants for a local cottage. Suddenly, Lucy's carefully constructed facade begins to crumble as past and present collide. The novel brilliantly contrasts her internal turmoil with the superficial social interactions surrounding her, garden parties and tennis matches, where she maintains the appearance of a contented fiancé while her inner life grows increasingly chaotic. George Emerson refuses to play by society's rules. The novel's most liberating scene occurs when he, Freddie, and Mr. Beebe go swimming in the sacred lake, abandoning themselves to youthful play until accidentally discovered by Lucy, Cecil, and Mrs. Honeychurch. This moment of uninhibited male physicality contrasts sharply with Cecil's cerebral detachment. When George later declares, "I want you to have your own thoughts, even when I hold you in my arms," he articulates everything Cecil cannot offer, love that embraces Lucy's individuality rather than constraining it. This revolutionary concept challenges the very foundation of Edwardian gender relations. His passionate critique of Cecil as the type who's kept Europe back for 1,000 years resonates with Lucy's unacknowledged frustrations. Though she breaks her engagement with Cecil that very evening, Lucy remains trapped in self-deception. Having freed herself from Cecil, she cannot admit her love for George. She resolves never to marry, planning an escape to Greece while lying to everyone, including herself, about her true feelings. How often do we, too, free ourselves from one constraint only to build another prison of our own making? At the piano, Lucy finds a realm where she's neither rebel nor slave, expressing a freedom absent from her daily life. Though not technically perfect, she plays with raw authenticity that more accomplished musicians often lack. Mr. Beebe's observation that she would be exciting if she lived as she played proves prescient. Her preference for Beethoven's structured compositions reflects her yearning for emotional clarity, while her later shift to Schumann's melancholy pieces mirrors her conflicted engagement period. Cecil's interruption of Lucy playing Gluck's Armide, music that never gains, never wanes, but ripples forever like the tideless seas of fairyland, reveals his emotional limitations. He fails to comprehend the sustained passion this piece represents, a quality he himself lacks. The novel's final musical moment carries symbolic weight when Lucy plays a song Cecil gave her, with lyrics advocating restraint. Taste not when the wine cup glistens, and easy live and quiet die. This philosophy of denial embodies everything Lucy ultimately rejects, a life devoid of passion and authentic emotion. The novel's climax arrives when Mr. Emerson tells Lucy, "You are in a muddle, and you love George." His declaration that it isn't possible to love and to part breaks through Lucy's defenses, allowing her to see to the bottom of her soul. Muddle represents confusion, self-deception, and social entanglement. Characters remain trapped by fear, convention, and inability to recognize their true desires. The solution lies in clarity, the metaphorical view that reveals life's essential truths beyond social constraints. Lucy's acknowledgement of her love for George becomes a moment of profound self-knowledge, embodying the novel's core value, the courage to recognize and act upon one's deepest truths despite social pressure. The story ends with the couple married in Florence, at the pension where they first met. They learn that Charlotte may have secretly enabled their union, suggesting that beneath her rigid propriety lies a romantic who recognizes true love. A Room with a View endures because its central metaphor remains deeply relevant. We all face choices between the safety of convention and the risk of authenticity. The room represents social constraint and predictable comfort, while the view embodies possibility and genuine self-expression. Forster brilliantly illustrates this choice through everyday decisions, from room arrangements to music selections to matters of the heart. Through Lucy's journey, we see how these seemingly small choices accumulate to shape a life either confined by fear or liberated by courage. The novel challenges us to examine where we've settled for rooms when views await, where we've chosen safety over authenticity. Its enduring message is that genuine living requires stepping beyond our confining rooms into the expansive view beyond, a journey that, while challenging, offers the reward of a life fully lived.